The fact that God is ultimately in control, that He's working His plan in history through good and through bad, is what gives me confidence to move forward in my life, to understand how I should vote, to understand how I should go forward in social issues.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
Jack, there is a moral issue that's very difficult to understand and to see clearly. I'm going to pose it to you and see if you can help us make some progress with it.
Okay.
There are some people, some of whom would consider themselves Christians, who believe that it is right to act in a violent way toward people who are pro-abortion. In fact, these people are, we hear about it in the news a lot, bombing abortion clinics or killing or hurting people who are involved in abortions in some way. The argument for them would be, how can we not protect an unborn child from the grips of these people who are killing them? Wouldn't it be right for us to go in and save the lives of these unborn children? And they would go on to say, how is that different than us seeing Hitler massacring the Jews? Don't we go into that country and say, stop? In fact, wasn't that one of the biggest complaints we have against what happened during that time in our history, that not enough of us went in and said stop? So do you see the dilemma?
Yes, I do.
How do you approach that?
Yeah. On the surface, the logic of declaring war against abortionists because they have basically forfeited their right to exist because of the war crimes that they are committing against unborn babies, that declaring war on them and going to war with them becoming violent toward them seems morally justified to people. And exactly, that's a very excellent parallel between Nazi Germany. Didn't we go against go to war against Hitler, in part at least? It was a complex situation, but in part at least, to put an end to the Holocaust that was happening. And how is that any different? Is that not a moral parallel? I think my answer is no, it's not a moral parallel, and maybe it would be helpful to go to the Civil War to find the difference. In the Civil War, you had two kinds of things happening. That is, prior to the Civil War, you had things like, what's it called, John Brown's massacre, where John Brown led an uprising of, I believe, slaves who went in and into a particular town and massacred a bunch of people in rebellion against the slavery there. And John Brown was a white man. I don't remember where he was from, but he was a very fanatical, charismatic, anti-slavery type guy who led an insurrection.
And his thoughts were, the black people are being hurt. They have a right then to go in and kill the people who are hurting them.
Yeah, essentially. Exactly. Now, there's John Brown on the one hand, and then on the other hand, there's Abraham Lincoln, who also hurt a lot of people, led his armies, or ordered his armies out into a very, very bloody war over the same issue. Are those morally parallel? And ultimately, I would argue, no, they're not. And I hope people will stay with me, because this may sound like pretty specious reasoning first. But
From the outset, it sounds like you're going to have to do some double talk.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it looks the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, superficially it certainly is the same.
Yeah, one's the president, and so he gets to do it. The other guy's just a regular old guy on the street, and he doesn't.
Right, right.
So you have quite an argument to make here.
Yeah, I think so.
Have fun, Jack.
Thank you. You really have put your finger on the crux of the matter, ultimately, and that is, one was the president, Abraham Lincoln was the president, and John Brown is not. Now, I'm not much of a respecter of presidents, but ultimately theology comes into play here, I think. And that is, one has to, as an individual, if I'm a John Brown or an Abraham Lincoln, I have to ask myself the question, what am I called to do? What is God doing in history? What does God want accomplished in history? In other words, how does God want this story to go? And I'm either going to submit to the story that God is telling, or I'm going to rebel against that story and presumptuously try to steer it the way I want it to go, not the way God wants it to go. It comes down to, I think, the only little fragment of political theory that we have in the Bible is in Romans 13, where he says, let every person, this is Paul writing to the Romans, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Now, there's a lot we could say about that, and maybe we will before we're done. What the part of it that I want to highlight for my purposes is, it seems to me that there's no way we can make any sense out of what Paul is saying here if we don't recognize that at the bare minimum, Paul believes that God shapes history through governing authorities. That that's how God's providence works its way out in the history of the nations, is by putting in place the governing authorities that he wants in place to do what they're going to do, to decide what they're going to decide, and so on. That's just as much true of Hitler as it's true of Abraham Lincoln. Both people were put there by God and were granted authority and power and influence by God in order to steer history in the way that he wanted history to go.
Now, to start off, Jack, that's a really big thing to swallow.
Yeah, it is.
I can see God working through Abraham Lincoln in a way that he's bringing justice and trying to bring justice and goodness into the world. That was at least an attempt. How well he did that, I'm not sure. There were a lot of lives lost in the way he did that. But it's very, very difficult to see that God would ever possibly be working through Hitler.
Mm-hmm. And I think because we have an even more fundamental problem, and that is we would like God to be the author of everything good in the world and somehow to be insulated from all the evil in the world. I assume that's behind...
Yes, that would be it.
We've dealt with that in an earlier program when we were talking about the sovereignty of God and his providence and his being ultimately the author of the whole of reality, both the good in reality and the evil in reality. Rather than revisit that whole topic, maybe suggest that listeners could get the tapes of those broadcasts to get my full picture of that.
Well, let me give a little sentence that might give us a bottom line.
Okay.
I'm hoping that this won't draw us into a rabbit hole because we're trying to face a really important issue here. But I don't know if we can pass this up. It seems that, Jack, ultimately, God is, and you're going to have to stay with me here, listeners, God is not as interested in us not sinning, or even in a leader not sinning, as using our own sin, the sins of our leader, the sins of the world, to bring us to an understanding of our need for him.
Right.
To make us people that understand reality clearly, and to make us people who want God. To make us wise people. Wise people are the ones that want God. And it seems to me that God uses all manner of things, all manner of people, both good and bad, to bring us to this wisdom, to bring us to this understanding of Him. And that is what He wants. And if we see life from that perspective, He wants us to know Him and to bow our knees to Him and to live our lives before Him. Then we can understand sovereignty.
Right.
Did I get it?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, 10 points.
And so, in the process of aiming at that goal and of carrying out that agenda, God does both good and evil. He brings light and darkness. He brings blessing and calamity. And all of that is a part of this overall story that God is telling as He dynamically works in our lives to lead us to a knowledge of Himself and repentance and a love of God. Or, conversely, to harden the hearts of those people who will never love Him. And He's doing both things in the world. Now, that's not a popular notion, that's not a popular theology today, but I'm convinced that it's what the Bible teaches, and as I said, I think we have two or three tapes where we explore that in more depth.
A lot more depth.
Yeah. So one of the things that God uses to accomplish His goals in the larger scope of history is by bringing nation against nation. Nation wars against nation. One nation is used to chastise another nation, punish another nation. One nation is brought in to destroy a whole civilization that is so corrupt that God says, I'm done with it, and I want to judge it. And God has been doing that throughout all of history.
I think so, Jack. When I can read the Old Testament and know that's true, to see that happening,
mm-hmm.
but it's very difficult to look at it in my own life, here and now, and not say, oh, it shouldn't be happening now.
You mean look at my own culture, my own society, my
right.
nation? And,
right. It's like that was the Old Testament thing that
uh-huh.
God did,
right.
but not the New Testament thing.
Yeah, it's easy to
a hard
see
thing
that.
To stomach.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And we see that a lot I see a resistance to that in my own heart, my own mind. I mean, what I would like to think is that of all the nations in the earth, God is surely going to bless this nation, America. And surely He's never going to destroy our civilization completely like He did Rome, and like He did Greece before them, and like He did Persia before that, and like He did Babylon before that. Surely we're different.
Or like even Kosovo.
Right.
Or even like a tidal wave, or even like a big hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
Surely God's not going to let these awful things happen here in the United
right.
States.
Right. And yet there's no way we can read the Bible and escape the conclusion that, well, of course He will. I mean, in the end time, there's going to be all kinds of natural disasters and all kinds of grief just before the end, and we're going to be subject to that just as much as the rest of the world is, in one way or another. It's just naive of us. It's very short-sighted and self-centered of us to think that because I'm here now, surely God will not bring any devastation on us and our society and our culture.
It's naive, but I also think that it's born out of fear. You know,
yeah.
I want to be safe,
yeah.
and it kind of makes me feel safe to think it's not going to happen here to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really scary notion.
And we need to. One of the things we need to do as Christians is shift the focal point of our safety. Recognize that my safety rests in the eternal promises of God, not in my own preferences, not in my own fantasies about what God is guaranteeing and what God is promising, but in the actual promises of God. Job put it most succinctly, though He slay me, yet will I worship Him. I may not have the safety that I want, but I've got the safety that I've got. And I need to recognize that I can rest in that and be content in that and even delight in that, recognizing that the safety He has promised me is really a wonderful safety and an ultimate safety that is more precious than any safety He could give me. But you're right, we want the safety on our terms, not on His terms.
And I think, Jack, unless we're brought to a place like where Job was, that we don't really consider that question too seriously. It doesn't look as though we're in a place where we need to consider that.
Right.
Job was in a place that he had to. Lots of people I work with compare their lives to Job, and I think they are in some ways such fortunate people because I don't think we actually ever look at the promises of God and really consider them on our lives until our lives are at stake.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Suffering brings clarity. Suffering raises the issues that really need answering.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. It does.
Okay. We got there from the Civil War.
Yeah, we did. Boy, are we good at rabbit trails. Okay, so you were saying, let me go back to that, is whether I'm a regular citizen or whether I'm President of the United States, do I have the right to, in essence, pronounce war on another person? You brought us to this scripture that said we need to obey the authorities of our land.
Mm-hmm. Right. And my point is not the obedience part. We can talk about that if you want, but my point rather is that the only thing that can make sense out of what Paul is saying in that passage is a recognition that Paul's underlying assumption is that God establishes authorities in his providence. Let me contrast it. One way you could read Romans 13 is to say God puts in place people who we should obey implicitly because they speak for God. No, that's not what Paul is saying.
On the surface, it sounds like that's what Paul is saying.
It does, yeah. But if I, and we can go back and discuss this if you want, but if we look at it in its context and really recognize what it is that he's saying, that's not what lies behind what he's saying. He's not saying they have every right to say whatever they want to say and command whatever they want to command and lead the government however they want to lead the government because God gave them that authority to do that. No, what Paul is saying is God providentially puts in place the governments that he wants in place. Those can be very ungodly governments who are doing exactly what God wouldn't want them to do, but God in his providence has put them in place in the overall scheme of things to accomplish his purposes. And as such, they are accomplishing the purposes of God. And that, insofar as that goes, is a good thing, is a right thing. It's God making history. So, if I'm an Abraham Lincoln and I recognize the providence of God, I acknowledge the providence of God, I recognize, therefore, that God is going to shape the course of history through a decision that I make. Because, for whatever reasons, by God's grace, God has, through the political realities of America, through the cultural realities of America, through the structures, the civil governmental structures that God put in place, God has used all those providentially to bring me to a place in history where what I decide to do is what God is going to do in history. Well, in recognizing that, I realize that I have to follow my conscience. I have to do what I believe is right before God to accomplish what I think is honoring to his values and to his heart. But I'm in a place where I have the authority to do that. I mean, this nation is supposed to follow me. This nation will follow me. I am not presuming to shape history. I have been given the authority by God to shape history. I'm not presuming to play that role. God has clearly given me that role. Or to put it another way, have I been called by God to shape history? Clearly I have. I'm the president. What if I'm just little old Jack Crabtree sitting in an obscure state? Huh?
Just hypothetically, huh?
Yeah, right. has God called me to shape history? Well, why would I think that? Unless it's presumption on my part. Or to change that, what if I'm John Brown? Could I force the issue and take it upon myself to go out and change history? Well, yeah, I can do that, but am I being presumptuous in doing that? Is it clear that God has given me that role, or am I being presumptuous? I would argue, given the violence, given the destructive impact, and the sheer horror of what he did, that he was being presumptuous. Now, I don't know that for sure. Can God call a private citizen to a kind of insurrection and it be the call of God? I can't rule that out of hand, a priori. Maybe so. And John Brown is going to have to answer for his actions. But as an outsider looking back through time, and knowing the human heart, knowing what we're capable of, knowing the kind of presumption we're capable of, my bet would be that John Brown was being presumptuous in a way that's evil, that is wrong, that lacks the humility that a disciple of Jesus should have. That would be my critique of the people who are seeking to assassinate abortion doctors and blow up clinics and so on, is that there's a presumption there, a lack of humility that does not characterize the disciple of Jesus. It's not that their actions are intrinsically wrong always and forever. There may very well come a time where abortion becomes one of the major issues in a civil war that will have to be fought in our country. That may very well be the case. And when that time comes, the same kind of horror and violence may characterize that war. But it will be done because God has raised up a whole nother government, a whole nother counter-government, that not just one person has presumed to take upon himself, but a whole community, a whole half of a nation has decided we have to follow our conscience, we have to do what's right here, and we'll rise up against the other half of the country and oppose its evil and say enough is enough. That will be a different state of affairs than just one person taking it upon himself arrogantly and presumptuously and without humility to fight a war that no one else is fighting. Now, I don't know if that's clear, but it seems to me that those are qualitatively different morally. They are not morally parallel. In the case of going to the war against Hitler, it was a decision that was made by the leadership of our nation that is ultimately providentially controlled by God. Was America called into that war? I think so, yes. God was calling America into that war. Were all the motives of the leaders of this nation pure? I doubt it. When have they ever been? Were they economically motivated? Probably. Were they selfishly motivated, egotistic? Was there some ego involved in any of those? Probably.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm thinking, is that there probably wasn't a lot of humility of heart in many of the decisions that leaders make, because leaders are like me. I'm a sinner. I'm a person who is often selfishly motivated, and I don't even know it. So we can't just say the leaders were non-presumptuous and the individuals are presumptuous. I would say both of us are, except for what you're saying is God has ordained the leaders as our leaders. And regardless of their evil or good intentions, their conscious or subconscious choices, still they are our leaders.
Right, yeah.
And that gives them the authority to make the decisions, where I, as an individual, a non-leader, don't have that role.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because you're right. I'm not for a second wanting to let any of the world leaders off the hook and saying their motives are pure. I don't know that we've ever seen anything in history happen that way. My point is, if I'm asking myself the question, as a disciple of Jesus, should I go to war? Should I personally declare war and kill people and destroy things over this issue just by myself, even if no one else will join me? What should give me pause is that question, even if no one else should join me. Because from a theological point of view, it seems to me that what we have to recognize is there's a kind of check on my presumption in numbers. If a whole society, if a whole culture, if a whole counterculture is in agreement that what we are being called by God to do is put an end to this, put an end to civilization as we know it in order to stop this evil and start, you know, bring this down and start all over. If we agree together that that's what we're going to do, then that's the hand of God moving in history, moving a group of people to destroy another civilization and to start something over again. Does God do that? Clearly he does. Could God do that in our midst? Yes, clearly he could. Is God doing that? I don't see it yet. And therefore, for me to just make a one-man war against this society is presumptuous, not just a presumptuousness of spirit, because even the world leaders who do God's work can have a presumptuousness of spirit, but objectively, I ought to be able to read that I am running out there on my own. This is not God calling me to this. This is my own heart grandstanding. This is my own heart doing something else that's motivated by the evil torment of my own heart. This isn't the providence of God at work. Because if it's the providence of God at work, then there's going to be a whole lot of people agreeing with me, and we as a whole counterculture are going to enter into a civil war, not just me trying to create foment. That's different.
Okay, and what I'd like to point out here also, Jack, is you're not saying that in all issues of our lives we have to make sure there's a lot of people behind us that agree with us to know that we're doing something right. We're talking about a very specific...
I'm talking about war.
Yeah. We're talking about war and violence against other people.
Yeah.
So I just want to make this clear, because I think sometimes people... We misunderstand unless
right.
we're very clear in our communication. There are times when I might make a very unpopular decision, and there may be other people that are definitely not behind me. I do need to take the counsel of other people, but sometimes other people might just not want me to go forward not out of love, but out of their own fears.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I need to not be presumptuous and just decide that I'm not going out of my own fear. I need to really search my heart and decide is whatever behavior I'm undertaking out of love, out of a good conscience. So that's
right.
just I'm just trying to clarify a small point here, but I think it could be very important.
Yeah, thank you. That's good.
Jack, can we go into some other
sure.
questions mm-hmm. about social activism or about just political questions? Sometimes it's very difficult to know for whom to vote.
Mm-hmm.
A man or a woman may have some political stands that I very much agree with, and my heart is really alongside them. And they may also hold to some political beliefs or some social beliefs that I'm very much against. I'm often in a quandary. How do I vote?
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I don't know if I have any wisdom to shed on that. Maybe I can just talk about my confusion on that issue. On the one hand, part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, it seems to me, this seems clear to me, is to be a person who lives a principled life and who takes his stand on principle, lives his life on principle. Now, there's a way to live your life on principle that is not very principled. I mean, that is really a distortion and not wisdom. I'm not talking about that.
What do you mean by a principled life?
That I don't think in terms of what are the consequences going to be, what is the result going to be, but rather I'm wanting to do what's right regardless of the consequences. I want to do the right thing, not the expedient thing. I want to do the right thing, not the effective thing. I want to do the right thing, not the practical thing.
I want to do the right thing, not necessarily the popular thing.
And certainly the right thing rather than the popular thing. Exactly. That's what I mean by principle. Now, some people make principles that are so rigid that it's no longer doing the right thing. They're actually doing the wrong thing in the name of principle. And we can fall in that direction, but I'm not talking about that. A disciple of Jesus is so committed to being godly and righteous and true and having integrity, we're committed to those things, that those are the things out of which we make our decisions and live our lives and make our choices. I'm tempted to think that should make its way into the way we vote then, that I should vote for the person who is the good person, the person who is the right person, the person who holds the right values, and should vote for that person as a matter of principle, you know, just because those are that represents, that person best approximates the ideal character and the ideal set of values. But then you have the problem that if people who are committed to that voted for that sort of person at the expense of the lesser of two evils, then maybe the greater of two evils would win the election. Because I was over here voting on principle and not voting what prudently I thought, and not voting in such a way that I would help contribute to the lesser of two evils winning rather than the greater of two evils winning an election. And that presents a real dilemma for me. I don't know if I have answered that for myself entirely. Part of what I have to take into account is, it's what we were talking about in, I think, one program ago, and we've talked about it a little bit today. God is not interested in necessarily, well, okay, let me start over. I have to realistically face into the fact that God has never promised to make America a godly culture and a godly civilization. That just, I think I would be misreading things. I think I would be naive to think that that's even a possibility in this culture. And yet, that's what I want to do. You know, I want this culture to be godly. I want it to be righteous. I want it to be right with God. And so if some prophet comes along and says, you know what, we all really need to repent and turn back to God, I mean, my heart leaps at that and says, yes, I want him as our leader. I want him as our president. But on the other hand, do I for a second think that that person could ever get elected with that message? And furthermore, that if he were by some divine intervention to get elected, that the heart of this nation is such that they would follow his leadership? Do I really think that that would happen? Well, no, not really. So do I vote for that person then because I like that person better than anyone else? Or do I try to read the situation and try to help elect a person who would be less evil than the alternatives? That's my confusion. I don't think I've answered that for myself right now. And I don't know that I can answer that for myself. Because I passionately believe in leaders with character, on the one hand. On the other hand, I can't be so naive to think that our culture is anything other than the ungodly culture that it is. So what do I do about that? Where I ultimately have to rest is, however I end up voting, whatever happens politically in our nation, God is in control. He's not out of control. That's where I can finally seek some rest. I think I would go crazy if I thought that the whole course of history was in my hands with my vote, that everything hinged on how I made up my mind on this particular issue. I can relax a little bit knowing that in the final analysis, there ain't nothing going to happen in America that God hasn't programmed, you know, that God hasn't scripted. It's going to go down. History's going to go down the way God wants it to go down, and my vote isn't going to change that. And so I can just give it my best shot, think it through the best I can, and trust God.
That's pretty much where I've come, is I really think that it's right to vote. I think it's right to vote in every election. I think that more of us need to do that. I think it's sad that we have this opportunity to vote and so many people do not. And yet, at the same time as I'm voting, I feel I have a sense of futility as I'm voting. What does this really matter? But I do vote, even though I have that feeling and even though I get very discouraged. God is at work doing his thing in our world, and we just participate as best we can. Mm-hmm. And I do think that much bigger, even though I think it's right to vote, I think much bigger is the way I live my life. It is my commitment to trying to do good, and God sees that in my heart. If I vote for the wrong person and they end up being a Hitler, I am very grieved about that. And yet, I think that grief is a part of God working in my life to help me see my own lack of wisdom, my own lack of understanding. And he would use that to mature my heart. And that's where I have to go. Very often when I look at political issues, I feel very futile. Although I try to work toward helping, I am very convinced that it is the way that I relate to my children, the way that I relate to my husband, the way that I relate to the people with whom I work, that really does make a difference, the way that I relate to myself. Those things are harder to me than the way I vote. Those things are bigger. The little decisions about whether I should be honest in a particular situation that maybe nobody would know and maybe I could come out looking cleaner than I really am. Do I tell the truth in those circumstances? When I want to be unkind to somebody because they hurt me and I want to get back at them, that's a much harder thing for me. It's a much more present thing for me than the way I vote or even any political cause that I bring forward. Those things that make me die in the very heart of my life, the things that are that feel so scary to me or feel like such an agony in my everyday life are what seems to count more. Mm-hmm. So that's where I go.
But I think all of those things can be true of our decision to vote as well. I mean, I think you've admitted as much that it can be a very agonizing kind of choice for you.
It is an agonizing choice, but it's out there.
Right. Yeah.
If I'm voting for a man, I'm not sure how he's going to ultimately be. There could even, if I choose to vote for the man of high moral character, I don't really know who he is. I know what he says he is. I know what he puts out there. But I don't know in the individual decisions of his life what he's going to do. I know he's going to make mistakes. I know even when I try, I make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So it's out there. It feels more fuzzy to me, more vague.
Right. No, than, I understand that. Yeah.
Than if I'm going to sit with my husband and listen to him tell me something that's hard for me to hear.
Right.
That's a much more difficult decision for me. If I shut up and listen and care about what he has to say and care about him, or just defend myself. That's here and now. That's very present.
Right. I do think that there's a question of integrity, though, even in the way we vote, and I acknowledge that it's more removed from me. And I think that's right, and it's appropriate that we would feel it that way, I think. But I can vote with integrity or with a lack of integrity. And if I vote because I want to be fashionable, then there's no integrity in my vote. And it seems to me, as a disciple of Jesus, that that's antithetical to everything that I stand for. It's understandable that we would be confused and limited and nonplussed by the decision and really at sea about what the right thing to do is. That's understandable. But to go into the voting booth and vote for Mr. X because he's the one that clearly all of our media culture stands behind. Everyone else is the butt of all the comedians' jokes. Everyone else is clearly put down at every turn by all the Hollywood elite and the media elite. And if I allow myself to be influenced by that and basically go, I want to be hip and groovy like everybody else, so I'm going to get behind who they're all behind. If that's the basis of my vote, well, what kind of disciple of Jesus am I? That doesn't make any sense at all. So I need to vote out of some kind of principle. The question is, which principle do I vote out of? And that's where it gets difficult. And that's where the problem, the real dilemma comes for us. And that's where, as brothers and sisters in Christ, we need to cut one another some slack. That God is not nearly as concerned about whether I picked the right person to choose for as why I voted the way I voted. I think it's very possible to vote for the wrong person out of a heart that's pure. And that's better than voting for the right person out of a heart that's not pure. I mean, it comes back to the same stuff we've been talking about over and over and over again throughout this program. But
out of a heart that's pure, you're not saying a perfect heart, a heart that's always godly, but out of a heart that wants good.
Exactly, yeah.
That's headed toward righteousness.
Yeah. I'm finite. I'm ignorant. I don't know the best kind of government to have. I don't know the best kind of government policies to have. I'm not sure anyone does, frankly, but I know that I don't. God is not going to blame me for my limitedness and my finiteness and my confusion about economics and politics. God is not going to hold that against me. If I vote the way I do because from my perspective that looks like the thing that would honor righteousness and God and truth and justice the most, then that's a good way to vote. That's a good heart to have. Never mind that you know, really I'm very, very hopelessly confused about the final result and the final consequence and the final impact of having that person in that set of policies rather than another. If I'm mistaken about that, then I'm mistaken about that. But all of that is going to come out in the wash of God's providence. God finally moved me to vote in that way along with the other people because that's the government he wanted. If nothing else, he might want that government in order to be the final destruction of our civilization. Is that a shame? Yeah, it's a tragedy. But in the overall scheme of things, it's what God wanted. It's what had to happen. It was the right thing. It was the good thing. It was the thing that's ultimately going to honor God in the end. And God is not going to judge me by the overall effect in history of my vote. He's going to judge me by the integrity of my heart.
Okay,
the thing I need to guard.
You're saying there's two things that are important here and that give you courage. One is that you are looking toward paying attention to the integrity of your own heart. Do I have a heart that wants goodness, that wants to love God, that wants to love people? My person that's headed toward what's right in God's eyes. And that's a very important component. The other thing that gives you courage is that you are understanding that ultimately, even when things look really bad, God is the one who's the author of all history. And that's what you rely on. You're falling back on that.
Yeah.
We're not ultimately making mistakes. It looks like we are. It looks like there's been a lot of mistakes in history, and yet it seems like, in fact, I think you're saying it's clear that God uses evil in the world, bad stuff throughout history to bring about his purposes. That's part of it.
Yeah.
That's a radical way. You're always kind of radical, Jack, way to look at things. But it gives you a backbone. You understand that God is the one that's in control of the world, and he's going to make it happen.
Yeah. I'd be paralyzed otherwise. I mean, if I thought that the world depended upon my vote, how would I ever vote? If I thought that the world depended upon my next choice, how would I make my next choice? I'm not God. I don't have his perspective. I don't have his wisdom. And that what gives us the freedom to just go ahead and do our best, give it our best shot, is knowing that in the end, nothing is out of God's control. And he will accomplish his purposes, and I won't destroy them, I won't wreck them, I won't get in the way, I won't interfere. I'm going to be right on schedule. But what I can guard is whether my heart is motivated by a love for God, a desire to know him, a desire to do what's good, a desire to do what's right, as best I can determine what that is in a very complex world and a very complex history.
I think of many people over the years with whom I have worked who really are paralyzed because they don't have that perspective. And I would hope for people out there who feel so discouraged and so unable to make decisions that you can hear this and that it might reach down into your heart and give you some peace. I really hope that for you. Jack, we only have about 5 minutes, but I want to pose kind of a difficult question. Here we are in a democratic society. I would say that probably democracy has been one of the best governments of the world. It has really done some good, especially early in our nation's history. Out of it was formed the Constitution, which has a lot of godly characteristics, a lot of good stuff to it. And yet, in our nation, we are thinking about changing this Constitution. We're thinking about taking away some of the precepts that we've stood on. And I wonder, if we took away this democratic society, sometimes if it might be better, as someone told me right before the show, we were talking about it, he said that maybe it is this government that's destroying us, because the godless people are the majority and voting toward godless things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand my question or my concern?
Yeah, it's a question that I've wrestled with off and on throughout my life. I think essentially what you're asking is democracy the best form of government, or is it not? I mean, is that ideally what we should have, or
is it maybe destroying us?
Or is it maybe destroying us? Right. The answer that I have finally come to, and I think living where I live at this time and place in history, is an interesting perspective with regard to this question. The conclusion that I've...
Jack, you're always kind of interesting in regard to these questions.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is America has looked so successful for so long, but I think we are in a position where we can see the end from here. We can see its destruction from here. And it has firmed me in my conclusion that there is no form of government in all of history, there's no form of government that one could even theoretically construct that is capable of controlling the evil of the human heart. The evil of the human heart will find a way to destroy every culture, every civilization, every government, and it seems to me that that's the history of the world, is that every civilization has destroyed itself because of human evil. There's no antidote to that other than just absolute transformation, recreation by God himself. And ultimately, the only ideal form of government is the kingdom of God, which cannot exist in this age and will only exist in the age to come. That's a conclusion that I feel fairly firmly and fairly strongly about now. And I don't know, you know, I don't know that I could be as confident and could be as firm in that if I couldn't see the destruction of America at this point in time.
So what you're saying is you both look at history and how governments have all fallen, maybe not necessarily because of their ideology, because even Marxism had some good ideology. But what's ruined it is the evil of our hearts. It's
right.
The sinfulness in our hearts.
Right.
It is that sin that works its way out in our culture, no matter how good of ideals we have. And you're saying you can see that even working its way out in democracy, in our nation today. You see things crumbling. You see unrighteousness rampant on the streets.
Yep.
And that is a indicator that we're on our way downhill, and there's really no stopping it but for God, who would change the hearts of each of the individuals, of each of us. And that won't happen here and now. That will happen in the kingdom of God.
That's right. When I was taking my civics classes as a child, which I don't think we give students any longer, but they would speak of the glories of the Republican form of government, the democracy that our founders founded, and that our strength lay in the checks and balances and the representative form of government and the fundamentally democratic form of government that we had, that was our real strength, and that's how we were going to endure. What has always struck me as interesting is when you go back to Plato and Aristotle both argued that democracy is the... that's not true. Aristotle argued that democracy is a bad form of government. He didn't have much fondness toward it. And Plato thought it was the worst form of government. Why such a different perspective? Well, because they had a very different experience. The Athenian democracy that Plato knew so well was horrible. And he saw it with his own eyes. Why was that democracy so horrible in the end, and American democracy was so good in the beginning? I think it had nothing to do with the form of government so much as it had to do with the worldview of the people. The worldview of the people that founded America was heavily impacted by the Judeo-Christian worldview. And that had a very, very positive effect on our culture and our society, and the level of decency and the level of conscience, the degree to which conscience reigned in every heart and in every citizen in our society, whereas that was not true in Athenian democracy. So it's not the form of government that has made America great to the extent that it has ever been great, but it's the impact of the Judeo-Christian worldview. Democracy will fail us to the extent that that Judeo-Christian worldview evaporates.
Most of the time, our relationship to our culture is like a fish to water. It is as though we are swimming in our culture. It surrounds us everywhere we go, and it can have a profound impact on the way we think and the values we hold. Because of its collective nature, culture can create momentum for ideas and beliefs, evil as well as good. In his News and Views article, Culture, Friend or Foe, McKenzie Study Center teacher Wes Hurd takes on the question of how should a Christian live in a post-Christian world. Wes argues that all too often the church is more aware of modern, non-Christian points of view and how they are biased against the biblical worldview than it is about its own cultural assumptions, which are much closer and often more damaging to its life. As believers, we need to know the truth of the gospel, and this includes understanding how the culture we live in can distort the gospel message and feed it back to us in ways that might seem to make sense. However, in this post-Christian world, we may have even more opportunities to share the gospel with others in fresh and meaningful ways. Call McKenzie and ask for your copy of Wes Hurd's Culture, Friend or Foe.
Jack, this week I was at a retreat where my husband spoke, and he talked about some very difficult realities of our lives, and my heart was just so encouraged by people who could hear it. In fact, one man walked up to me with tears in his eyes and was just talking about what he heard and what a important thing it was that was being said to him. It just broke his heart open. And sometimes when we receive letters from people, I get that same feeling, that there are some people whose hearts we speak right into, and they write us letters and say that so well, sometimes very short. But let me read you a letter where somebody said that. I would like to express at this time my gratitude to Jack and Christine for the weekly broadcast. I find the broadcast really enables me to think about why I believe what I believe. I have been especially blessed through the series on biblical sexuality and the one about relationships. It warms my heart to hear you speak for those of us who struggle in ways that may not be easy for some to understand. God has given you a heart of compassion and ability to feel so deeply. Please know that your ministry is of great value and truly a blessing. And I think that it's so good that someone's heart is really being spoken into, yeah, that they're grasping what we're saying and that it means something to them. I'd encourage those of you who find this to be a meaningful program where somehow it kind of breaks your heart open or it breaks your mind open, that you would consider giving to this ministry. I remember very early on when I, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, Jack, where I heard you speak, and it just was such a enlightenment to my heart. Finally, it's like the clouds broke through and I could see the sun, and it was really good. And it's from that point that I started supporting your ministry, both in listening to what you said and to giving financially in the direction that you were teaching, to you and to the ministries that you were a part of.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mckenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of McKenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.